From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in the 1980s in an elementary school classroom in a rural part of western New York. It was a regular day with the teacher delivering her lesson and the students doing their work. But suddenly the teacher stopped her lesson and spoke to one student in particular, a boy named Kyle. As Kyle remembers it, the teacher told him to quit making noises and, quote, doing that thing you're doing with your head. And then she demonstrated in front of the whole class what Kyle had been doing, imitated him. All of the kids turned to look at their classmate. Humiliated, Kyle put his head down. He later said, I could not tell her that I couldn't help myself. The behavior that the teacher was so callously describing was the result of a condition Kyle didn't know he had. Now an adult, Kyle says that for as long as he can remember, he has had the vocal and motor tics associated with Tourette syndrome. And as for as long as he can remember, he's been working to hide them. Kyle and his family didn't know what Tourette syndrome was, and it wasn't until his adulthood that Kyle received an official diagnosis. In fact, he didn't see a doctor about the condition until a severe bout of tics caused him to rear-end a car. Kyle's Kyle Semmel, a local author and translator. He's been a guest on this program many times. He is no stranger to publishing work, but a recent piece for Huffington Post really took him out of his comfort zone. The piece is titled, quote, I always knew I was different. Still, I was shocked to hear my doctor say these four words to me. And it explores Kyle's experiences with Tourette syndrome and the shame and humiliation he has felt throughout his life as he struggled to hide his tics. But Kyle says it doesn't have to be that way, and he doesn't want others to experience the stigma he has dealt with. He says his goal is to help normalize Tourette syndrome by talking and writing about it. He's joining us this hour to do just that, and we're going to talk to him. We're going to talk to a local clinician who treats Tourette syndrome and is a Tourette syndrome patient himself. A lot to talk about this hour. Kyle Semmel, a local author, translator, and the debut novel, by the way, is coming out October 1st. I can't wait to talk to you then. So this will be a little bit more uncomfortable for you this hour, because I know that you were a little uncomfortable publishing the piece, but I want to say that you're definitely helping people. I think it's beautiful. Thank you for being here and telling your story.
Thank you for having me, Evan.
Yeah, it's great to have you back here. And welcome Dr. Peter Morrison, assistant professor in the Department of Neurology, Movement Disorders at UR Medicine, and a Tourette syndrome patient as well. Is that right?
That is correct.
Hey, welcome. Thank you for being here.
You're welcome.
I want to start just briefly with Kyle and say that the reaction to publishing this piece has probably been even more than you expected, huh? I mean, can you take us through how it came together for HuffPo to begin with and what it has been like to be on the receiving end of all this feedback?
Yeah, I can. I actually wrote the piece probably in the fall of last year. It didn't publish until April, the end of April. And it was just a recognition that I think I just wanted to tell the story, my story, that is. And, you know, I was looking for outlets that would publish a piece like that. And, of course, Huffington Post, the personal essays that they published there, really stood out as a possibility. So, yeah, it's basically how that happened. I pitched the editor, and they took it. But it was like a 4-month delay between when they accepted it and when they published it.
But tied up in all of that is a decision that you are going to put this out there publicly.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder how much you wrestled with the decision to do that.
Yeah. So you mentioned the Book of Losman, this novel that's coming out in October. And part of the reason that I wrote the book, the novel, I should say, is that it is my novelistic attempt to come to terms and to understand what Tourette is, at least for the character in this novel. And so I wanted to kind of introduce that element of my life when it, you know, with the novel. So I felt I needed to kind of introduce it before the novel as well, to have a discussion before the novel actually came out about what Tourette is and what it is for me. Now, it's a novel, so it's fiction. So this is not, you know, I like to joke that it's about 99% false and fictional, you know. So, but there's a core element of truth in it, and that is, of course, the Tourette element that I have experienced all my life.
We're going to read a little portions of Kyle's piece coming up here and get Dr. Morrison's take as well. And listeners who are hearing this program, you may have an idea of what Tourette is. We're going to talk about some of the stereotype and some of the harmful stereotype about what Tourette is as well. But I can also say that there have been many people who've already reached out to Kyle, who maybe isn't, you know, the most emotional guy. But the responses have been so positive. You've got parents who are thanking you. You've got people saying that this story is feels like their story. What has that been like?
It was amazing. It still is amazing. On the very first day alone, so April 29th, there were more than 500,000 views of the piece. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean full reads, but it means that a lot of people read
it. It's a lot of reads.
Yeah.
It's a lot.
And that's, of course, just in one day. And the number of responses I got, and I respond to everyone, but the number of responses I got were just, it was overwhelming. But like you said, most of the folks were very positive. And it felt good, and it felt especially good for the adults who wrote to me, who, you know, adults with Tourette's who maybe had never been diagnosed. There were people in their 70s or 80s who had lifelong tics and who felt I had told their story. And that really was quite a phenomenal experience, particularly for me, since I have spent the majority of my life hiding that from others and feeling like I was alone, but then realizing after publishing that I wasn't. So that felt really nice.
You were nervous to see how Dr. Morrison would respond to the piece?
Well, Dr. Morrison was also the one who diagnosed me 6 years ago. It's weird being diagnosed as an adult, even if you've had the tics all your life, because you feel like you're a bit of an imposter, so to speak. Because I didn't have any sort of inclination early on. I just knew I had these tics and I couldn't really stop. But as I mentioned in the piece, one of the things that when I was a kid, my mom and I watched an episode, I think it was 60 Minutes, but I can't guarantee that anymore. And there was a boy on a public bus, and I think in the city of Chicago, who was essentially had coprolalia. He was shouting, he was swearing, he was very loud and vocal. And so when I thought of Tourette, I thought of that. And so
I think a lot of people do.
Yeah. And so it has been a bit of an education to learn, you know, that it's not always the case. And in fact, as I mentioned that in that article, it's only one in, what is it, 1 in 10? Maybe Dr. Morrison can speak on this because it's a very small number of people who actually have that.
Doctor?
Yeah, I would say in terms of the coprolalia, about 10% or less of individuals will actually have that. So it's rare, you know, but that's how people perceive it, unfortunately. And there's a lot of negative stigma, you know, about having Tourette syndrome in tics. And so, you know, for me, and I can certainly go into this a little bit more, it's about education and educating people and understand what are tics, what's the definition of tics, what's the roadmap of disease, what are the comorbidities, right? Because a lot of times we get fearful when we don't understand, right? And having education can sometimes help settle that down and have a better sense of, okay, this is what I have, this is who I am, but it's not going to change me as an individual. And that's really what I try to tell patients after making the diagnosis, is that it's not all about the stigmata that you hear. You're an individual that has Tourette syndrome, but it's no different than having any other medical condition, and you can certainly be successful. And there are many people out there with Tourette syndrome that are successful.
I have a family member who's been very successful, who has Tourette syndrome, and I, as a child, did not know that some of his, and the right word is ticking, or some of his tics, is that?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
I did not know that some of his ticking was related to it. So, you know, I'm a preteen child. He's exhibiting, and by the way, his sort of evolved over time. But I made a remark that it wasn't the most cutting thing ever, but I'm not going to repeat the remark here. But it was just a cheeky remark that a 12 or 11-year-old would make. And a family member pulled me aside and was like, here's what's going on. And I will never forget that, because I felt, you know, so low even as a kid. But I also felt very confused, you know, very in the dark about what it was or even how to help. So that's probably a lot of people, right? I mean, we're going to talk to Kyle about his story. We'll talk to doctor about his own story. But for people who haven't sort of experienced TRED up close, you may have a stereotype, or you may kids may be confused. That's probably not unusual, I assume, doctor.
Yeah, very much so. Again, you know, with Google nowadays, you type things in and it gives you a diagnosis, whether that's accurate or not. But that's where obviously seeing the medical professional can be helpful to try to differentiate that and give you a clear sense, okay, what are tics? What are, you know, how is it defined? And how do we approach these things? You know, if you have a friend with tics, what do we do? Do we not, you know, point it out? Do we just kind of go with it? Again, in the end, you really just want to be there to support and to educate. And that's not only family members, that's school teachers, coaches, because there's a lot of interaction that children have. And obviously, it's not just going to affect children, but as they grow into adulthood, it can certainly affect them. And we can certainly go into that a little bit more. But again, to me, it's really just about the education and trying to get rid of the stigmata and the stereotypes related to it and just understanding what it is.
Kyle, can I read a little bit from your piece, and then we'll talk more about your story, if that's all right?
Sure.
All right, you write, quote, "For me, ticking has always meant a near-constant urge to do things with my body. Urge may not be the right word for these head jerks, blinks, snorts, grunts, throat clearings, tongue clicks, etc., but it's the best I've got. From the moment I wake up to the moment I fall asleep, my body seems to have a will of its own. In any given hour, I probably tick at least 100 times. During periods of great stress, like when I rear-ended that car, my tics are like a parasitic fungus that assumes total control over my body," end quote. That's a lot. When did you really first, tell listeners when you first were aware of it?
Well, it was that classroom, for one. And I know from that moment on, so I've had a lifelong wish not to be, I don't know, put on display, so to speak.
Not to stand out.
Not to stand out, yeah. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. And so that was a horrible experience that basically meant that I had to reconfigure how I viewed myself, so to speak. So I wouldn't, you know, when I had those urges to tick, that I had to control them. And so I learned that. So it was, I would say, what, fourth, fifth grade, whenever that was. I don't know exactly what year it was. But it was really that episode more than any that kind of made me realize that this is something that other people don't have, other kids.
Are you surprised that you didn't have a diagnosis in your childhood?
No. So I grew up in a working class family in the country. And as I mentioned, we saw this episode on 60 Minutes, and I just don't think that they, my parents that is, thought of what I was doing as worth being diagnosed. It was for whatever reason, and this is not a complaint on my parents. I love my parents, and they were great parents. But I just think it was a different time. We didn't talk about neurodiversity then. We didn't talk about things like Tourette. And if we did, it was glorified by the coprolalia, or things that were much more digestible. How do I say this? They were just more public, more media interest than just simple tics. And no matter, yeah, I'll just leave it at that.
Yeah, I think from, you know, also sometimes a parent perspective, we perceive these as habits or behaviors that people are doing and that our child shouldn't be doing these habits and behaviors, but they're really not. That's not what the definition of a tic is. These are involuntary, repetitive, stereotyped movements and sounds. And so again, I think it comes back to the educational component and what the stereotypes are. And that if they think, oh, this is just my child, you know, having some behaviors or habits, you know, we're not going to really talk about it. I've had several cases of this where people have had tics all their life and never had a formal diagnosis. And again, there's many various reasons for that, but some of the similar stories that I hear or roads to that are that my parents just didn't want to address it. They thought there was behavioral or habits and didn't really realize that this is a neurologic condition.
Let me read a little bit more about how you attempted to hide it. And I admit in reading this, it's... Yeah, I really feel for you. I think about, you know, my family story. I think about anyone who's feeling like you have to hide something that you're feeling this intensely. and either feeling embarrassment or, as you've said, the desire just to stay out of the spotlight entirely. You're right. As a kid, to shield myself from shame and embarrassment, I developed an arsenal of tick hiding strategies. Instead of jerking my head, I would put my hand underneath the table and waggle my fingers or ball my fists repeatedly. Instead of snorting or chuffing obvious and strange sounds, I'd click my tongue softly, like an irregular metronome. When I'm out in public today, I'm keenly aware of my internal pressure to tick, but I've become adept at suppressing it, bottling it up, and capping it tight. At home, when I'm free to be myself, it's a very different story. My tics come and go. End quote. And on the subject of feeling lonely, you said, I've also experienced moments of deep loneliness. Retreating into yourself is a good way to not be publicly embarrassed, but you pay a price. Eventually, you end up feeling like a ghost in your own life, known to no one but yourself and a few carefully curated individuals whom you trust. I don't make friends easily. End quote. Does the wisdom of time change any of that for you? And by that I mean, you know, the old saw is that you spend your 20s trying to look 30 and you try in your 30s trying to look like you're still in your 20s. And then by the time you're in your 40s, you don't care because you're self-assured. You're comfortable with who you are and you're comfortable with who you love and surround yourself with, and you're comfortable that they can accept you. Has that happened?
Yeah, I think so. I think certainly I feel more comfortable in who I am now. At age 49, there's a lot of shame, I think, as at least for me when I was younger, and feeling a sense of worthlessness as well. And you do outgrow that when you start to realize as you get older that you have a lot to offer, a lot to offer others as well. So, yeah, definitely I feel now more comfortable sharing this. I wouldn't be here otherwise, and I wouldn't have written the HuffPost piece if I didn't feel that.
I found you intimidating when I first met you.
I don't know why. I'm not.
Because you're obviously deeply intellectual. Most writers I find somewhat intimidating because I admire it so much. And, you know, when I first really got to know you, you're at an organization, Writers and Books, that, you know, it's titanic in this community. So I thought, well, this guy's going to see through me. He's going to see that I'm an intellectual lightweight. And it's so interesting. I bring this up, Kyle, because, you know, now that I know, you know, you're a baseball nerd and, you know, like you're just a dude who's also a great writer. But I bring this up because it's so easy to have this idea of what the world must be thinking of us. And most of the time, people are caught up in their own stuff. They're not even really noticing your tics, or they're not judging you, or they're not, you know, people are just, they've got their own stuff. Like, that's okay. But it's also often true that when you're worried that other people may have negative perceptions, actually very positive perceptions about you, and you're not letting yourself understand that because you're so caught up in what they must be thinking about, in your case, tics. And I just hope that you have found a level of peace with that.
Yeah, for sure. I don't know what else to add to that, but I definitely feel there's a level of peace. But, you know, it's also, I should say, that it's not simply the tics over the years. There's other contributing factors to why you might feel a sense of shame or worthlessness. Mm. It's not just that. So it's hard to know when that ends and something else begins. And as you get older, you do feel a sense of, for lack of a better term, wisdom. You grow as an individual, and you know, in the best life, that's what you're doing constantly. You're getting better as a human being, and that's around now. I certainly feel like I'm coming into a better place.
One other point I want to go over with Kyle, and then we're going to talk to the doctor not only about his own personal story, but I really want to make sure that we kind of work through the mechanics and help listeners fully understand Tourette here. But when you talk in the piece about this, the spark moment, there's when you saw the 60 Minutes piece, as you said, the focus on that piece was on kind of the loud public swearing component. And you haven't had that. So it's not like you looked at the piece and you were like, oh my gosh, that's me. And yet, it did put you on a path to saying, something's up here. So that was a significant moment. Why was it not until this car accident that, you know, I mean, like, kind of take me through that and then tell listeners about the car accident.
Well, to be clear, the spark moment was the classroom, not the 60 Minutes episode. That was just something I remember, because I very distinctly remember that. And so the spark moment was the classroom scene. And so
the teacher almost mocking you.
Yeah, and I want to be clear on this. One thing is, I really liked that teacher, and I to this day still like that teacher, and I have no animosity towards her.
She didn't know.
She didn't know. It was a different age, completely different age.
That's also really generous and very human of you to say that, and I think there's some beauty there.
Well, like you said before, you know, what one person may throw away as a comment is not meant to be cutting. And yet it is to that person. And when you're, 12, 13 years old, it's even deeper.
Yeah.
So I want to be clear on that. And then over my life, moments of extreme stress would produce higher volumes of tics. In my experience, that's been a major facet. And so I was under tremendous stress at that particular moment. And I was driving, I think it was in Victor, I believe. Mm-hmm. And I was just driving and ticking pretty fiercely. And I rear-ended somebody. So it wasn't like it was a massive accident. But ever since I was in my 20s and driving and ticking and driving, because, you know, when you're out in public and you have to hold back your tics, then the place you're going to have your tics when you release that is in your car driving wherever you're going. And I used to think to myself that someday I'm going to probably die while driving. Wow. Because this is where I'm ticking the most, and it's also the worst possible time to do it. And so at that time, my son was around 5. When I was in Victor, he was not with me in the car, and I was ticking so badly then I just hit the car in front of me. And they were really nice. It was a man and woman, and they were super nice. There was nothing. We were going like 5 miles an hour, so it wasn't that bad. So they were very good about it. But that's when I realized that I didn't want to die in a car, and especially when my son was 5, and that I would have to figure out what this is. And maybe there's some sort of pill I could take that would help me not do this anymore. And so that's when I went to, you know, one of the beautiful things is that Rochester has URMC in this, Tourette Center. And Dr. Morrison can explain it, but, like, you know, when you Google that, you see, like, Rochester has one of the largest and best Tourette centers in the country, and it was right here. So it felt like, okay, I'm gonna go do this and figure out what this is. And so that's how I ended up seeing Dr. Morrison.
And you said that diagnosis might have been a shock, but it was a relief.
It was, for sure. For sure, because it gave name to something that I had never. Thought about.
Was he an easy diagnosis?
Yeah, I mean, it was
straightforward.
It was straightforward, right? I mean, there was clear history of both motor and vocal tics, you know, from childhood. And, you know, when I initially see someone in the adult clinic for concern of tics, you know, we don't necessarily think of onset of tics in adulthood. So you really got to get the history. And clearly in Kyle's case, he had tics from a kid. And that's what it was this entire time. We just needed to put a name to it, whether subconsciously we kind of knew potentially that's what it was going to be or not. But again, I think that just really helps patients to understand, okay, here's the diagnosis. This is what we're dealing with. What is the roadmap of disease like, right? That's what a lot of patients want to know, regardless of what the diagnosis is what's my roadmap? What do I expect? Are there treatments? Are there not treatments? Are there other things that we should expect? And, you know, even from my personal standpoint, I had kind of a spark moment too when I was younger, around a similar age, 8, 9 years old, on the soccer field, avid soccer player. And I love my coach. He was a great coach, won us a lot of championships. But I remember standing on the line, he goes, Morrison, stop making faces. You know, and so that to me was the spark moment as well, in terms of something was different about me. Clearly, I was having movements that I couldn't necessarily control. But I didn't know what that was. But in, you know, my case, my parents, you know, they just elected to go to the pediatrician, see a neurologist, and ended up getting the diagnosis early. And again, you know, as a 10-year-old trying to understand what Tourette syndrome is, how that's going to impact me. That's hard to do, right? That takes time. But I think understanding the diagnosis and being comfortable with it myself was the first step. And then knowing that I'm still going to be the same individual, no matter what, going forward, that there were treatments if we needed, and great support. And so that was kind of the difference with me is that, you know, again, I think a big part of it, too, is the social-emotional aspect. Yes, there's the physical component, you know, pain, discomfort, fatiguing, but there's that social-emotional. When you're out in public, what the perception is, how people are thinking about you. And that is not only in school age, that goes into relationships, girlfriends, boyfriends, you know, going forward, how much do I divulge? They're obviously noticing that I'm doing it.
Yeah.
Do you want to divulge? What's your comfort level there, right? And everyone has different comfort levels, but to me, the way that I looked at it personally, again, I'm not saying that everyone is the same, but I felt education was key in being upfront about who I was. You know, these are tics. They're out of my control. It's who I am. And a lot of times I saw the benefit of that compared to, okay, we'll end the relationship then because I don't want to be someone who has tics or coprolalia, right? I think a lot of times there was benefit with my friends so that they understood what was going on. Again, the lack of knowledge sometimes makes people scared or they just don't know. And then kids are mean, they make fun of another, right? So, you know, that was the perception I took going forward. And I think for me, that really helped as I developed different relationships.
When you talk about divulging as relationships grow, romantic relationships, friendships, whatever, I'm thinking about the word that Kyle used, the wisdom, to know that I really want to see the good in people. And I think most people, if someone comes to them and says, I want to tell you something a little bit about me, I don't think most people are going to run out of the room screaming or point and laugh. I think they're going to say, hey, thanks for opening up with me. Like, how are you doing? Like, you know, but at the same time, you have to develop this belief that putting yourself out there can yield that result when it's not guaranteed, even if it's more likely than you think, especially as a kid, right? I mean, kids are probably not trained to think that this is going to go really well if I tell something about, that's unusual about me. It seemed like you developed a comfort level with it pretty quickly, though, Doctor.
Yeah, I did. But there's also a sense of vulnerability, right, in terms of divulging that. And you always think about the worst case scenario. Like you said, most people are probably going to be accepting and understanding and acknowledge that and want to educate themselves about it. But we always think about the worst case scenario that, you know what, no, they're not going to understand. I'm going to be off in the corner. I'm going to be isolated. I'm going to feel ashamed of myself. Yeah, there is a sense of vulnerability at times. And, you know, but everyone's different in terms of when they get to that point of understanding what the diagnosis is, feeling comfortable about it, and being able to speak about it.
There's a question a listener has that I think is going to lead into a portion of the program. We're going to talk about, you know, how the doctor wants us to think about if treatment is the right word or adaptation, et cetera. So this is Shirley. Hi, Shirley. Go ahead.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have two quick questions. One is whether or not the doctor is aware of cases of Tourette that people have outgrown. If it's been diagnosed in childhood, have you seen cases where it has been outgrown? And my second question is, I believe there is some OCD perhaps associated with Tourette's. And are you aware, if that's the case, are you aware of people who have managed to handle that OCD and channel it into being very productive, highly productive, because of that tinge of OCD?
Okay, doctor?
Yeah, so with regards to the first question, what I would say is, as people get older, in general, not always, tics tend to improve in frequency and severity now. Whether they completely go away, meaning that if you had a camera on someone for 24 hours a day for the rest of their life, would you probably see them still have tics? Probably. But the general education that I give is that they get better in the majority, not always, about 66 to 75% in frequency and severity. Have I had individuals that come in as an adult and they say they have no tics? Absolutely, I do. But again, whether they just don't notice them and they're still having them, obviously that's the question. But in general, I educate that tics get better with age, not always. And I have had some individuals that really say they have minimal to no tics as they get older. With regards to the second question, that is a great point, because when we talk about Tourette syndrome in tics, it's not just a motor or vocal aspect of disease. We have to be very conscious and aware of what's called comorbidities that commonly co-occur with Tourette syndrome. It's not that the tics and the Tourette's cause these. They're commonly clustered together. That includes ADHD, anxiety, depression, OCD, just to name a few. So basically, as a clinician, when I see someone, whether it's a child or an adult with Tourette syndrome, that's just the tip of the iceberg, quote unquote. And then I really have to do a good job not only to assess the tics and whether or not to treat them, but to assess for these other comorbidities of ADHD, anxiety, depression, OCD. Because again, all of these symptoms can impact quality of life. And that's really what it's about in terms of treating patients. You want to improve their quality of life, symptom frequency and severity. And sometimes it's not the tics. Maybe that's the back burner and it's the OCD. Maybe it's the depression. So these are all things, again, as awareness, education, that we need to think about, that when we see a child or an adult with Tourette, there could be a lot more underneath the surface than just their tics.
That answer the question there?
Yes, it does. I guess the second part had to do with if you've seen high-achieving adults whose tinge of OCD as a result of Tourette's has somehow been channeled into very productive, highly efficient behavior.
100%, I would say one is myself. I'm a very open individual, and I've, you know, talked with Kyle about this in terms of, you know, not only having Tourette, but some of the comorbidities, you know, OCD, anxiety, ADHD. And again, I tried to channel some of that into my benefit, you know, in terms of my OCD being very rigid, you know, about homework and grades and being successful and as accurate as I can be. Obviously, there's some aspects of the OCD that I don't want to have, right, of course, but I tried to, in a sense, use that to my advantage as best as I could. And so, at least for myself, I feel like I was able to have even more success, though I had that comorbidity, somehow funnel it into making it positive.
Kyle, when you got a diagnosis, did you find yourself researching, you know, prominent people who have it? I mean, I'm thinking when I was growing up, I think Mahmoud Abdul-Rauf, who was an NBA player, Chris Jackson was his name before he changed his name to Mahmoud Abdul-Rauf in the 90s. I think he had Tourette syndrome.
Jim Eisenreich.
Yeah. Oh, Jim Eisenreich.
Yeah, Philadelphia.
I did read that piece in the New York Times. And there was a guy, the goaltender for
Tim Howard.
Tim Howard,
for the U.S.
Oh, of
team.
Course, Tim Howard, yes.
Yeah, and more recently, Billie Eilish. Mm-hmm. The singer.
So you are aware. It just hits your radar more.
I'm aware, but I don't think I specifically reached out for any research on what famous people had Tourette's.
And Gary, our colleague here, sends this list includes Dan Aykroyd, Howie Mandel, Billy Irish, Mozart, David Beckham, Mahmoud Abdul-Rauf, Kurt Cobain. That's just a starter list.
Kurt Cobain.
That's the list. Listen, this is not verified by Dr. Morrison. This is just. But Gary Puttup has not been wrong on any of his research so far. So let's take our only break of the hour. If you're on the line, we'll get your phone calls. If you want to email the program, connections@wxxi.org. We're talking about Tourette syndrome. In our show notes, when we post the audio for this program, wherever your podcasts are sold, we will link you to Kyle's piece. As you heard him say, back in April, it dropped in HuffPo. There was 500,000 views in a day, and it has really, really moved a lot of people. He's talking about his own story of Tourette, and so we're bringing it to you today. And Dr. Peter Morrison is also talking about his own story as a Tourette syndrome patient, but also a professor in the Department of Neurology Movement Disorders at UR Medicine. We'll come right back with more of your feedback next. I'm Evan Dawson. Wednesday on The Next Connections, in our first hour, a special rebroadcast of a recent conversation about Monroe County's JEDS program. It's a diversion program for kids who have stolen cars, and we'll talk about how it works and meet someone who has graduated from JEDS. In our second hour, we preview the annual Rochester Pride Parade and Festival. Talk with you Wednesday. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Kevin in Brighton is next on the phone. Hello, Kevin.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
I'm calling because I'm on the autism spectrum, and I'm just wondering about comorbidity with autism and Tourette's, because when I was younger, like I was starting about maybe 8 or 9 years old, I started having tics and stuff. Yeah, I couldn't stop myself from moving in certain ways, and it got to be really bothersome for a while. But then, you know, I learned to control it a bit better. I have, like I said, I'm also on the autism spectrum, and I'm wondering if they're often comorbid.
Yeah, what I would say is certainly I do see a fair amount of patients with a history of autism that also have tics and Tourette syndrome. But again, just having you know, a history of tics or Tourette syndrome doesn't mean that you also have autism. But it is certainly something that I see in a fair amount of patients, but not always.
But it's not necessarily a connection between the two?
You know, that's really hard. I think, you know, the underlying mechanism of disease, you know, for both of those, there's still a lot of uncertainties there. You know, and so I think there's still uncertainty in regards to that mechanistically and, you know, physiologically. But certainly I do see, you know, a fair amount of patients with Tourette syndrome that also have autism. But the vice versa doesn't have to be true where they have autism and not have Tourette syndrome.
Okay. All right. I was wondering, I also have autistic children. So I was wondering whether I haven't seen anything in them that would resemble Tourette's, but I was just curious for myself and for them.
Yeah, so that's a great question. You know, when we talk about specifically of Tourette's with genetics, right? Because that's one thing, you know, even as a patient that I was worried about, you know, as I have children, are they going to have Tourette syndrome? You know, do I have to worry about that? You know, there's still a lot unknown. There is some research looking at different genetic components, SLITRIX1 gene, histidine mutation receptor. But again, it's a similar premise of you certainly have patients who have those mutations that have Tourette, but then they have this mutation and don't, and vice versa. So there's still a lot out there we don't know. Certainly there's a genetic component that I think can go into it. But it's hard for me to be definitive about having a certain percentage risk of passing it on to a child.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Yeah, Kevin, thank you. Thanks for the phone call. 844-295-TALK. It's toll-free, 844-295-8255. 263-WXXI if you're calling from Rochester, 263-9994. Again, our email address, connections@WXXI.org. JT wants to know, he said, in case he missed it, is there any progress with medications, or he said one of your guests mentioned taking a pill for Tourette's. So go ahead, doctor.
Yeah. So what I would say at this point, treatment is symptomatic only, meaning to improve symptoms to improve quality of life. And there's various medications out there for tics, and they've been around for 20, 30, 40 years. You know, there have been some recent studies, and I don't know how specific you want me to get in terms of looking at what's called VMAT2 inhibitors.
I think this is a wonky audience, doctor. People want to know.
Fair enough. So, you know, there are recent studies on VMAT2 inhibitors of valbenazine and Ingrezza and deutetrabenazine and Austedo, which were recently have been used for tardive dyskinesia and Korean Huntington's disease. And unfortunately, those were unsuccessful in patients with tics. There is a recent phase 3 trial that just started for Ecopipam, if I did not butcher the name of that, basically is looking at a novel mechanism for the treatment of tics. In phase 2 study, there looked like there was some benefit. And so now they're opening up to phase 3 for this medication. So, you know, we're looking to try to find novel medications for symptom treatment. But again, that is very different than finding something that's curative. Okay. So again, it's, you know, important to understand the difference of what is symptomatic treatment, disease modifying, curative, things like that.
I want to ask Kyle a little bit more about this because, number one, were you disappointed after you got your diagnosis 6 years ago? Were you disappointed to find out, well, I can't just take a pill a day and all the symptoms are automatically gone?
I think so, yeah. Because I did take, and what was the name of that?
Guanfacine.
Guanfacine, yes. And all it did was make me wake up at 3 a.m. thirsty. And the thirstiest I've ever been in my life was taking that. And guanfacine is, you can obviously say it's better, but it's basically a blood thinner, right?
No. So it's what's called an alpha-2 agonist. So it basically reduces the central release of norepinephrine, serotonin, things like that. So it's actually used as an antihypertensive. So it weakly lowers blood pressure and heart rate, but somehow through its mechanism helps to reduce motor and vocal tics.
It didn't for me. And so I decided that it was not worth trying or worth taking anymore.
Okay. And so, okay, then you have to, I guess, decide, what are you going to do about this? Now, you wrote in the piece about suppressing tics, and I want to ask, I mean, this is going to be a little clumsy. I apologize to both of you. But Kyle, when you're talking about kind of fighting tics or tic urges and kind of channeling them into, you know, maybe you'll kind of ball your fists under a table instead of letting people see what's going on and another part of your body, how effective are you at actually sort of redirecting tics?
I mean, I like to think I'm pretty effective, but I also I actually talked to a friend of mine from high school and asked him if he had noticed that, and he did. So I don't know how effective I actually was at doing it. I just assumed I was because nobody really said anything. I didn't have issues in school where people were picking on me. I never had that. Other than, you know, I would get people doing the, you know, blinky thing when I blinked and they would blink back at me, but nobody really made fun of me for them. So I assumed I did a fine job controlling that.
Okay. And part of what I'm curious about is, physically, are there times where you can't redirect a tick?
Yeah.
Yeah.
There are times when the ticking is so forceful that my neck hurts or other parts of my body begin to hurt. For whatever reason, the funniest ticks I have involve brushing my teeth. There are times when I brush my teeth and I'm shaking my head and I'm spitting on myself because I can't. I can't really pull it back. Don't know why.
I appreciate you saying funny because have you found a way for yourself to sort of laugh at that in those?
Yeah, I mean, you have to. You have to. And like part of growing older and part of seeing who you are is like understanding your foibles as a human being and trying to just think of that. It's just who you are and you have to laugh. You have to have humor in life. And you know, one of the reasons, you know, when you read this novel, you'll, for example, going back to the novel, this is
Kyle's new book that's coming out October 1.
October 1.
It's called The Book of Losman.
Yeah. And there's humor in it because you have to be able to laugh.
Do you ever wonder where it came from? I mean, I have this thing where I don't like to say odd numbers out loud. I like to only say even numbers out loud. And if I say an odd number out loud, I like to then say an even number because that will be the last number that came out of my mouth. I don't like to look at odd numbers. I can look at them, but then I want to make sure I look at an even number next. I have no idea where that came from. And listeners are probably listening to this thinking, it's among the weirder things that have been said on this program. It's true. I don't like, if I'm touching things with my hand, I like my right hand to be the last to touch instead of my left. And ideally, my pinky finger last because there's a fluidity to it. I have no idea where this comes from. And I'll do it like subconsciously. I'll be on a steering wheel and I'll take my hand off the wheel and I'll make sure my right hand comes off last and my pinky finger touches last. That's a real thing. I have no idea. I'm only bringing this up not to make the program about me, but there are times where I wonder what is this about me that made this happen? And do you wonder that about yourself with Tourette? Like, how did this happen?
First, I want to say that's a really amazing recognition you just said.
I'm putting it out. Kyle, you've convinced me. I can put it all out there.
You should, yeah. And yes, I certainly do because there's nobody in my family who has tics at all. There was a moment when my son was little when I was concerned that he might, but he doesn't now.
Okay.
So yeah, I often wonder, and that's, you know, part of the reason, again, going back to the novel, that's why I you know, I'm very curious. I have no idea, but I'm very curious as to why.
I'm looking at the timer of the clock. You see that? Everybody's looking at the clock in the studio. It's 1:50 and 14 seconds. I'll look at it many times in the hour just to know what time it is. I try to look away when it's an even number. Just want you to know that. There you go. I don't know when it comes to Tourette. Kyle may be wondering. He's looking at family history, but he's not seeing any.
Yeah.
What do we know about causes?
Yeah, so, you know, kind of going back to the gentleman's question, you know, about family history and genetics, as I mentioned, there may be some genetic components, and we're still doing a lot of research on that, but there are certainly individuals where there's no family history of it. You know, we simply term it idiopathic. We're not really sure why. Similar with Parkinson's. Like, why did I develop Parkinson's? There's no family history of Parkinson's in my family, so why did I develop it, right? So it's complex in terms of development, the brain, and maybe some genetic components. You know, we're still doing a lot of research on that. Clearly, there are some disorders that are 100% genetic. If you have this gene and a certain amount of repeats, you're going to express disease. But it's not so simple with Tourette syndrome in that case.
Well, let me read a little bit more of the feedback we're getting, which is you know, probably a small molehill compared to the mountain that Kyle Semmel has had since April with his piece in HuffPo. John says, I have a child with Tourette's and OCD. By the way, doctor, do we say Tourette or Tourette. A lot of people say Tourette's for shorthand. Is that
okay?
Yeah,
and then Tourette syndrome. Yeah.
But that's okay. Okay. He says, I have a child with Tourette's and OCD. We've tried and cycled through some different medications along with cognitive behavioral therapy with mixed results. The degree of his tics ebbs and flows. Any input on CBD oils or gummies?
I knew I wasn't going to get off the air without having someone comment on that.
Is this a controversial
that.
One?
No. What I would say, no, it's a hot topic, right, I think, nowadays in a lot of aspects of different disease processes. But neurologically, yeah, a lot of people ask about CBD and medical marijuana and things like that. You know, it is a hot topic, whether it's for Parkinson's, Tourette, seizures, things like that. You know, what I would say is in the Tourette realm, you know, we don't have the great evidence right now for CBD and THC and medical marijuana. So again, a lot of what we do is data-driven, okay? And right now, we just don't necessarily have that. But it's not to say that, again, different clinical trials can develop looking at different mechanisms like that.
Okay. Kyle, you had a big smile at that question. Anything you want to add on CBD or gummies?
No, I just thought that would come up. And, you know, it's fun.
It's legal.
I will say it has not done anything for me.
Okay. Yeah. Which is a sample size of one. We try to make sure that we... Kyle's story, I think, is so important because, for me, it's the human side of being able to talk publicly about things that are hard to talk about. But his story is his story, and John's son, and you know, the doctor in studio, and my family member, it's all different, and it's I know that can be challenging. Joanne writes, "What is the evaluation process for determining whether someone has Tourette's?"
Yeah, so a lot of times it will come to a specialist like myself in terms of neurology, sometimes psychiatry, but even pediatricians, you know, are capable. But basically, from a diagnosis standpoint, you have to have at least two motor tics and one vocal tic for greater than a year. That is what is termed Tourette syndrome. Before that, you know, people come in and they have 6 months of tics. Well, what is that? Is that Tourette syndrome? Well, that's just labeled a provisional tic disorder. Basically, the threshold is from 1 year. If they have tics for more than a year, then it's a chronic tic disorder, one of which is Tourette syndrome, where you have both motor and vocal. But some just have motor, some just have vocal. But Tourette syndrome has just been coined to having both motor and vocal tics for more than a year.
Okay. Before we wrap up here, I'm thinking of the teacher that Kyle talked about, a teacher that Kyle liked and still has fondness for, but a teacher who didn't know that when she was sort of mimicking Kyle's tics as a kid who was, what, around 10, 9, 10, 11, something like that?
Something like that.
That would stay with Kyle, and that would do, you know, some damage. And I don't want to speak out of school, but it seems like some of the feedback you have gotten is people or parents, individuals who can remember their own story of someone who didn't know that they were making fun of a tic. And there's a real kind of sadness in hearing some of that feedback. What have you sort of learned from some of that feedback, Kyle?
Well, I won't get into what some of the people have said, sure, because it's very private, but a lot of it was heartbreaking just in terms of and thinking particularly folks who were older than me, who, you know, they grew up at an age when these things were anomalies and people were, they didn't have a good sense of them. So I guess what I'm saying is, like, I do feel now, parents now are more equipped to deal with or to understand that these things are part of a larger, process, and that, kids can have these things and they're still okay. You know, it's some of the folks that I had talked to had really been traumatized by their parents. And I don't think, at least I hope that doesn't happen as much today.
And on that note, the way Tourette's is portrayed in the media is often, what's the particular, it's coprolalia?
Correct.
You've heard Kyle and the doctor say, because they're used to talking about this, but that's the actual form of Tourette syndrome where people might shout obscenities. Coprolalia, it only affects roughly 10% of people with Tourette. Something like that, doctor?
Yeah, or a little bit less, somewhere in there.
Maybe even in single digits.
Yep.
And Kyle has said it is not as common as popular media likes to portray it. Why is that the common portrayal, do you think, Kyle?
Well, I was somewhat clumsily saying this earlier, but I think that it is easy for the media to latch on to something that is dramatically interesting. And if you took one person with a mild version of Tourette, such as what I would say, such as me, and then compare that or put that person next to someone with coprolalia on a bus, they're going to gravitate towards that person. And okay. that's what I mean by that.
And then the trouble becomes when the public assumes that that is Tourette,
right,
as opposed to a 10% or less manifestation of Tourette syndrome. I also think it's probably a trouble when it's played for laughs. And I'm not someone who can't laugh, but I think we got to be careful in spots like that. I can think of a number of cases of popular shows and things like that. So I think we've learned a lot this hour. We're going to post Kyle's piece that has been up since April. We'll post it as part of our show notes so you can read it, share it, certainly. And doctor, if people need to get in touch with a clinician, what's the best thing they should do?
Yeah, I think first you always start with your primary care physician, whether that is the pediatrician in terms of child or even in the adult with their internal medicine physician, and then potentially refer if needed to a specialist like a neurologist.
And don't be afraid to ask questions about it, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah, I'm so appreciative. Dr. Peter Morrison, a professor in the Department of Neurology and Movement Disorder at UR Medicine. Thanks for coming in and sharing your expertise with us.
You're very welcome.
Kyle Semmel, we're going to bring Kyle back right around October 1st when Kyle's debut novel, The Book of Losman, comes out. It's about a literary translator, like Kyle, with Tourette, like Kyle. That's maybe where the similarities end, apparently. But we can't wait. Come back in the fall. We're going to have a great conversation.
We will, and thanks for having me.
Congratulations on the book that's forthcoming, and thank you for sharing your story, Kyle. From all of us at Connections, thank you for listening. We're back with you tomorrow on Member Supported Public Radio.